7 out of 10 proctologists recommend listening to The Drew Marshall Show.
Little Stevie Ray Vaughan, folks. I remember, this is something, again, I probably shouldn't share, but
well,
I remember.
It is The Drew Marshall Show, so the standards are pretty low.
I remember growing up in a funeral home, stealing the hearse before I got my driver's license, and driving down Young Street with this tune cranked in the hearse. Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Mary had a little lamb.
His fleece is
white as snow, yeah.
In the original uncut version, his fleece is black as coal.
Oh, really? Yeah. Just like cherry cola instead of Coca-Cola?
There you go.
You even know what I'm talking about?
No idea. I'm just smiling
Lola
and nodding.
From the Kinks. They had to change it for copyright.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I'll shut up now.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Tobolowsky.
We hope we're saying that right.
Tobolowsky. He has appeared in over 200 movies and television shows and is probably best known for playing Ned Ryerson in Groundhog Day, Sammy Jenkins in Memento, Werner Brandis in Sneakers, Happy Chapman in Garfield. I don't want to keep going. This goes on and on and on. Freaky Friday, Seinfeld, Deadwood, Heroes, Glee, Californication. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. He is a very interesting chap. With a couple of very interesting books as well, which we will discuss momentarily. His most recent film, though, however, is Christian Mingle, the movie, which also stars Lacey Chabert.
Lacey Chabert.
That's the way we say it in Canada, apparently. And it's just been released on DVD. ChristianMingleTheMovie.com is a website you want to go to. But it is my privilege to introduce the great pianist, and no, we're not talking Stewbags. I said piano player from the south of Russia, Mr. Stephen Tobolowsky. Sir, how are you today?
That's pretty funny.
Thank you.
That's very funny. The piano reference to the south of Russia made me giggle right before I come on the air.
Thank you.
That's not fair.
But I do want to just get really excited about, like, you had a little giggle, and I've been giggling ever since I found out. You used to play with Stevie Ray Vaughan. Are you kidding me?
Well, I guess there has to be an asterisk there.
Yes.
We were in a very terrible kind of folk rock band in high school / when I was a freshman in college and in high school. And we were picked as one of the five Dallas bands to each band would perform two songs on an album of kind of, well, this is even before garage bands, because back then, people used the garages for cars and power tools and stuff. We were like a living room band. We were like a hallway after school band. We were that kind of band.
Yeah, basement with a panel board band.
Yeah, oh yeah. We're on our way over to record our two songs, and Bobby Foreman, who was really the only guy in our group with real talent, who went on to be in the new Christy Minstrels, he turned around and said, well, you know, I asked this kid in our neighborhood, Stevie Bond, if he would play lead guitar on our two songs. I said, Stevie Bond, who's he? And Bobby says, well, he's this 14-year-old kid. And then I said, Bobby, a 14-year-old kid? You got to be kidding. We could do our own guitar. We don't need some kid. And then Bobby turned around to me and said, Stephen, shut up. This kid, this Stevie Bond, is really good, and he's going to make us sound like we know what we're doing. And so we showed up to record our songs. And there's Stevie there with his Gibson on his lap. And he says, you guys want to play me a little bit of what you're going to do so I can figure out what I'm going to do? We played about 8 seconds. And he held up his hand and said, okay, stop. Okay, I know what I'm going to do. So we laid down our tracks. And then Stevie, they asked him to do his lead. And he said, well, you know, these are kind of really bad songs. So I'm thinking, what if I do a really crummy lead and then, like, break into a good lead? And so we were slightly insulted, but then he got up and recorded. And the look on everyone's face, everyone was in kind of a shock. And the guy behind the glass said, son, do you think you'd do another lead? And Stevie laughed and said, oh, yeah, I can do another one. And he started wailing and playing this magnificent lead. And like a fly on the wall, I'm looking through the recorder people behind the glass, and they're going down the hallway yelling at one another, you got to come in here and look at this. And Stevie did another lead, and then all the grown-ups in the studio were looking like monkeys at the zoo with their noses up against the glass, and you could just feel the awe in the room, because I'm thinking it was like the first time any of us saw the real thing.
Man.
And I mean, like, genius thing.
Man.
It turned out to be these two songs were the first two songs Stevie Ray Vaughan ever recorded, and I'm selling those now on Amazon.
Oh, man. Well, his little brother, Jimmy, is he still with the Fabulous Thunderbirds?
Well, I don't know if Jimmy is still with the Thunderbirds. He could be. We did a Great Balls of Fire together, something like 18 years or something after Stevie and I did that one song. Yeah. And so I used to go out and party with Jimmy, which usually meant staying up all night. We were over at Cuba Recording Studios and playing around with all the equipment. And it was dawn, and Jimmy and I went to a diner to get breakfast. We weren't working that day on the movie. And the place was empty except for Stevie Ray. And Jimmy and Stevie Ray had had some kind of argument, family argument. They hadn't really talked to each other in like a couple of years. And I, of course, ran over to Stevie and said, Stevie, it's Stephen Tobolowsky. Remember Cast of Thousands? And Stevie gave me the stink eye and said, don't. We don't do that here. And the three of us sat down and had breakfast. And it was at that breakfast that Jimmy and Stevie began to reconcile. And Jimmy said, all I want to do, man, is play with you. And Stevie says, all I want to do is play with you too. And Jimmy says, what if we do a double album? And that turned out to be Family Style. And so from that point on, after we would shoot during the day, Jimmy would go over to Kiva with Stevie, and they would lay down the basic tracks, and almost a poetic ending to the story is when we finished shooting the movie Great Balls of Fire, Stevie said, you know, Eric Clapton asked me to go play with him up at a concert. Would you like to come too and play with us on stage to Jimmy Vaughan? And so they went and played with their idol at that rock concert up in, where was it, Minnesota? Whatever, that way up north, Milwaukee, wherever it was.
Yeah.
And Stevie jumps on the helicopter. Jimmy jumps on the helicopter. Jimmy's wife, Connie, jumps on the helicopter, and the pilot says, excuse me, ma'am, we've got too much weight. So Connie jumped out, and Jimmy said, I'm sorry, where my wife goes, I go. And Jimmy jumped off the helicopter. And the helicopter never made altitude. It climbed, they say, to about 50 feet and then just crashed. And that was the end of Stevie, and Jimmy was devastated. And the next time I saw Jimmy was about a year later, and he said that he put that album together, the double album of Family Style together, as an act of mourning for Stevie. And that's one thing I think immortalizes that album,
sure.
That it represents everything that rock and roll is, you know, love and pain and the desire to play all night long. And,
man, okay, this interview is going to go a lot longer than I thought, because you are just a walking story machine. Holy jumping. No, it's more than cool, man.
Okay.
All right, so the first really important question I have for you.
Yes, sir.
How are the cats? Belle, Cashmere?
The cats are, well, Finn, as you probably already know, is demented in some way. And we're having problems with him. Cashmere has reverted to his feral ways, and Belle is the perfect cat, and no one can take Belle from us. Let me just say something to the men in your audience about my cats. Belle was a rescue cat, which my wife found on Facebook. Someone posted the damn picture of the cat saying that they were going to execute it the next day at this pet place.
Oh, okay.
And my wife came to me and said, oh, Stephen, can we get this cat? And I said, absolutely, honey. I did not know at the time that the pound where they were going to execute this cat was somewhere in the middle of the California desert, about 2.5 hours away. So I spent the next day driving to get this cat. Waited there all day, brought this cat home, and this cat is so filled with love and gratitude to us for saving her from certain death, and it just so happened it was on our anniversary.
Oh.
So right now, I am in that fortunate state where my wife says, Stephen, you never have to get me another anniversary present again.
Yes.
Because you got me Belle.
Well done. Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Tobolowsky on the Drew Marshall Show. We could stop the interview right there. You have given us more wisdom in that line, that story. Oh, man, that's insane. All right, well, I'm glad the cats are doing well. I kind of want to start this whole thing with a great quote from you, and then I want to finish with a great quote from you. The first one goes something like this. Our brains are broken down to 65% needs, 25% wants, and 10% Mick Jagger. And what I want to know is, because he's figured this out later, Tim, he has said, you know, he's modified that a little bit, but I want to know, at what age does Willie Nelson start to steal some of that equation?
I think I have determined that the Willie Nelson part of the brain starts to form when you find the cheerleaders at football games interesting to watch, like on television.
Oh,
as opposed to the football game. Usually when they show the cheerleaders dancing is when I go get a drink. But around the age 50, I'm thinking like, you know, these cheerleader girls are pretty good dancers. And I think it's at that point where I think what I would say is the Willie Nelson, literally the Willie Nelson part of the brain is formed by little bits of regret.
Yes.
That turn into something a little softer along the way and consequently usable. And for me, the first symptom of it was watching the cheerleaders dance. First symptom.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Is it true that you first got the, well, maybe not the first time, but one of the times you really got the acting bug was when you pulled a Victor Borg in high school at the piano recital?
It wasn't in high school. It was before high school, but that is amazingly true. I am blown away by this research. This is crazy. I was warned that you do your research. This is absolutely, I was about 14, and I was doing a recital, and I was near the end of the program. Back in those days, the better you got playing the piano, the closer you were to the end of the program. So I was the next to the last piece, and I was doing this very kind of familiar, complicated song that began with these gigantic chords and arpeggios, three of them, boom, 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 going higher and higher, and I played them so well and so perfectly. For the first time ever in my life, I thought, you know, I'm going to add a fourth one. And don't ask me why. And so I went to play on the piano, and there were no notes there. And so I slammed on this chord and fell off at the end of the piano bench. And the audience gasped. I jumped to my feet and said, no, 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 no. That says so, it says so right here in the music. And I held up my music and said, pianist falls off bench. And I pointed, and they all began laughing and applauding, and I bowed, and I sat back down, and I began playing my song again. I thought, hey, you know, I'm pretty good at this. Not playing the piano, but making people laugh. Maybe I'm in the wrong profession. And that's when I started taking drama classes.
Yeah. Well, okay, so speaking of drama classes, what do you think, Stephen, would happen if you ran into your old university teacher, the one who tried to push you out of acting school?
Well, it would mean I was dead.
Oh.
She died about 8 years ago.
I'm sorry to bring that up.
No, that's quite all right. It happens to the best of us.
Yes, I've heard.
And also to the worst of us, which we have to remember.
Yes.
What I would say to Joan, if we lived in a world where we weren't bound by physical limitations of life and breath and kindness, I would say, Joan, none of that made any difference at all. And if the listeners don't exactly know what happened, I had a teacher in college who tried to run me out of school and keep me from graduating and ruin my life. And she manipulated. She manipulated events to make this happen. She wasn't even willing to let me fall on my own sword because I was too good of a student. She tried to manipulate it to where she was... can we use the word evil in Canada?
Only when talking about the NFL.
Okay. She had an evil streak in her, a meanness. And again, it was picking on a student who was helping. Now, when I told this story, and this story, by the way, is in my first book, Dangerous Animals Club. I told this story in Seattle for an audience. Of all things, there was a student, my fellow student, had moved to Seattle, and she ran up to meet me after the show and hugged me and said that this teacher had done the same thing to her.
Wow.
But her response was not the same as mine. She just crumbled and folded and got out of acting, ended up leaving the drama department, and she was forced out, and she said her entire life, she felt like a failure until she heard my story, and then she realized she was dealing with a crazy person.
Man.
So I always feel there's kind of healing in telling true stories. So what I try to do is kind of tell true stories and keep them as unexaggerated as possible because the truth is so more incredible than anything you can make up.
Okay, so who do you think sleeps less at night, character actors or lead actors?
Oh, that's a great question. I think no actor sleeps well at night, but for different reasons. I think leading actors don't sleep well because they know with each job they get, and they only get like one a year, two every 3 years, something like that, their entire career rides on how that film does at the box office. Whereas character actors, we don't. We move on from film to film to film. Some succeed, some fail. We keep moving on. They'll cast me as long as they need the tall, bald guy. And we don't sleep. Character actors don't sleep when we go through those dry periods where we get no call, where we get nothing, no help. And we have to find a way of dealing with that big nothing, that big silence, which is very debilitating.
Would you rather audition or not really?
I would love to audition, always. I always, and this is for the young actors out there who listen to the show, is that I always used to think the place I want to be is where I just get offers. And like Corbin, you know, for Christian Mingle, you know, he offered me that part. That's great. Well, that's a friend. I figured nothing bad's going to happen. But a lot of times, when you are offered a part, that means someone owes someone else a favor.
Yeah.
And that first week on the set is a week you could be fired because the other producers didn't sign off on you, and maybe they want favors, and they'll use you as a bargaining chip. So I have always found that when you audition for everybody, as many times as they want, you are not going to get fired from that job. And also, you know who you're working for in a lot of different ways.
That's great, great advice. I asked that in particular for our engineer here, Tim the Tool, as he's affectionately known, because he is a drama teacher. So there you go, Tim.
Yeah, I'm a high school drama teacher, so I'm going to record some of this and play it for my students. That's some great stuff, actually. Yeah, thanks.
Words of wisdom from Ned Ryerson. When Harold Ramis died almost a year ago, how did you hear the news, Stephen?
It was about 7 in the morning, L.A. time, and Slate magazine or online, whatever Slate is, Slate.com, whatever, the editor of Slate asked me if I would write a piece on Harold Ramis. Now, this is 7 a.m., and I just heard it from him, and I was floored. And so he said, could I have a piece and could we have it in the next couple of hours? So I sat down and started writing and wrote it and sent it in. And that, so my introduction to Harold's passing was his obituary.
Wow.
The act of writing it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like Jimmy Vaughn.
Yeah.
The act of doing the album. Yeah.
Can you, I've heard you share this, and I'd like you to share it for our listeners. Please explain, especially to Tim here, the direction that Harold gave you for the role of Ned Ryerson.
It was about, he told me many things, which I will cherish. One of the most important, acting-wise, I'll give you two. One, he told me acting-wise, we were shooting the very first day of Groundhog Day, and I was doing the big street scene, the first big street scene with Bill Murray. We had about nine of them, actually. I don't know, I think maybe three or four ended up in the film. I asked Harold, I said, you know, I'm playing this a little broadly. You know, in fact, you could, my performance maybe would work in the Roman Colosseum. Is this okay? And Harold Ramis says, you know, when we do a comedy, we have a stew. We have the stew, and we have the spice in the stew. Bill Murray in this piece is the stew. So he has to play it straight. You are the spice in the stew. You could do whatever you want. And the amazing thing about that movie is, as I look at it through that lens that Harold Ramis gave, is that Bill Murray, in one of the great comic performances of all time, in my opinion, mm-hmm. he's able to shift from being the stew in scenes with me to being the spice in the stew in scenes with Andy, where he's at the diner throwing food down his face. He's able to be the crazy one in that, and he's able to switch back and forth effortlessly, and the audience goes with him mm-hmm. as either our everyman hero or our wild and crazy guy who's the spice in the stew. One thing Harold Ramis told me is a life thing, and this is for all the college and high school drama students out there. Again, that first day, he said, it is impossible to become an actor. No one can do it unless you have four heroes, four angels, who come to your assistance. Now, you never know who they are. You never know when they will show up. But no one who has succeeded has ever done it without them. And for me, Harold didn't know it. I never got the chance to tell him. He was one of my four angels.
Very cool. Very. I thought you were going to say Larry, Curly, Moe, and Shemp.
Hey, they are certainly they're certainly my great professors.
Yeah. Give us one word as you remember your date with Faye Dunaway. One word.
Amazed.
You can't.
Amazed.
You
can't,
Okay.
Amazed.
Okay. All right.
It's always how you say it, right?
All right. Give us one word to describe the advice Mel Gibson had for you on how to be a father.
Brilliant.
Huh.
Brilliant.
Okay.
Heartfelt. Oh, that's two words.
That's two words. Cheating.
It's hyphenated. It's okay.
Heartfelt brilliance.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Most people recognize you from what? Art's Deli?
Yeah, Art's Deli. No. I think Art's Deli, they all recognize me there, that's for sure. I think the number one culprit is still probably Groundhog Day. Number two right now is probably Californication, because I don't know if that plays in Canada, but people see it.
Yeah.
A lot of me in that show.
Oh, really?
And oh yes, unfortunately. And then probably number three would be Glee, maybe.
Do you have a stunt double in Californication?
Oh, I wish I did. I did four of the seven seasons, and it was between the fourth and the fifth season I had open heart surgery,
oh.
which is a whole other kettle of fish.
Yeah.
And so Tom Kapanos, who's the writer, producer, genius behind Californication, called me up at home, not really aware of what I'd been going through. And he said, Stephen, we want to do a nude scene with you, the first show of Californication this season. Are you all right with that? And I said, well, Tom, I'm all right with it, but I don't look the same as I did last season. I've lost about 20, 25 pounds, and I had open heart surgery, so I have this enormous scar down the center of me where they cracked me open. And there was a pause on the other end of the line, and then Tom goes, great, we love that stuff. So,
oh, man.
I have to say, on the screen, you can't even see that I had a scar.
No. Well, that's disappointing. Speaking of scars, I hear that you love your wife's guts, literally. I mean, you've seen her guts open on a laying there on a towel sometime.
Yeah, that was a really unfortunate moment. I'm not a squeamish person at all for some reason. I'm squeamish about ideas of things, like the idea of a tick bothers me, which is why I would stay out of the woods. I mean, Rocky Mountain spotted fever kind of thing.
Okay.
I was there with our first son's birth, and my wife just squirted that child out like a football. It was amazing. You know, she's part hillbilly, and she just like, and it just flew out.
Deflategate.
Deflategate. There it is. Deflategate 1, 2. Oh,
man. Second baby was going to be cesarean section. And for some reason, they still allowed me in there. So they, you know, they put the little blue towel over her head so she can't see what's going on. But I'm on the other side of the towel, kind of in the action section of my wife's. And they've cut her open, and they start pulling out internal organs and laying them out on either side of her.
It's like a scene from Braveheart.
It was... It was either a theme from Braveheart or Dr. Fives Rises Again. I'm not sure. It was horrifying. But they're pulling out various internal organs. They're still attached, you know, but they just pull them out, and then they take the baby out of her stomach. And Anne looked to me, and she was saying, Stephen, I feel like they're pressing on my bladder. I feel like they're pushing on my bladder. And I go, no, baby. They're not.
No, your bladder's in the other room. Don't worry about it.
Your bladder is elsewhere, my love. My dear. Don't even worry about that.
Oh.
And yeah, that was. But it was amazing. When Anne gave birth to that first baby, you know, Robert came flying out. And then the next thing that came out was the placenta. And I had never seen a placenta before. And it was beautiful. It was iridescent. It was like at the inside of a seashell. It was this large thing, and I remember Anne was lying there with her feet in the stirrups, gasping for air, and she said, you know, she'd just given birth, and she said, they had wrapped little Robert up, and I'm holding the placenta, and she said, can I see it? And I said, sure, and I put the plate with the placenta under her face, and she said, the baby. I meant the baby, please.
Jesus, that's like the Marx Brothers giving birth, that whole thing there. That's ridiculous. Oh, man.
I'm just amazed at how gorgeous that was. What a world.
Man, what a world, what a world.
Yeah.
Stephen Tobolowsky on the phone with us. Growing up in Texas, not a lot of Jews, I would imagine.
I would say we had about three in our town. Three, yeah. Not many.
No. Ethical family, but not necessarily a, quote, practicing Jewish family. Is that about accurate?
I think that's extraordinarily accurate, more accurate than I would have put it. But ethical, yes. Practicing, no.
So yeah. When you went out to L.A., you kept telling your mom that you were going to find a synagogue. Why did it take years for that to actually happen?
Boy, why do things change and why do they stay the same? I think I felt something was missing in my life, which is why I kept up with the fiction with my mother that I was still looking for a synagogue. I was, a lot of times we speak in terms of our good intentions rather than what we're really doing. And I never really got around to it until just kind of by accident. I was doing a television program, a comedy, one of those sitcom things. And our producers, who were Jewish, said, well, as it so happens, one of our first shows, we're going to be shooting on Rosh Hashanah, which is, of course, one of the two high holy days of the year. Anyone have a problem with that? And Richard Kind, who was on the show, who's a hilarious comedian, said, well, you don't have to worry about us. The only two Jews you got on this show are me and Tobolowsky. We're the best kind of Jews. We don't believe in anything. And everybody laughed, but Barry Kemp, who was the producer, looked at me kind of very seriously and said, Stephen, are you okay with that? And I said, sure, Barry, sure. Because, like, when push comes to shove, you know, we all become one of two things. We're what we say, or we are what we defend. And if those two coincide, then it so happens that we are someone with purpose. Mm. But why is it that I am going to screw up a job on television I have for a religion that I hadn't practiced in 20 years? So anyway, I go home that night, and I can't sleep. And I'm tossing and turning. And I'm thinking, what the hell is going on with me? I wake up at dawn, and I'm in a sweat. And I'm thinking, I got to find a synagogue. And I remembered I had just worked with Larry Miller the year before on a film. And he told me of a little synagogue he went to in my neck of the woods. I didn't exactly know where it was, but I started driving down Moore Park Street in Colfax. I knew it was in that kind of area, and started going concentric circles thinking, let me just see if I run into something that looks Jewish. And sure enough, on one of the corners, there was like a little white house.
And it was a bagel shop.
That was Sunny Lock. It had a little Star of David on the top. I thought, I wonder if that... So it's about 7:30 in the morning, something like this, and this old man is out there wearing this leather cap and leather jacket, sweeping up. And I drove by, and I said, hello, excuse me. And the old man said, yeah, yes. I said, I need a ticket for Rosh Hashanah this year. And the old man is sweeping and says, well, there are no tickets. I said, well, look, I only need one. He says, I understand, but there are no tickets. And I said, I'll do anything. Listen, you don't understand. I haven't been in a long time, and I need to go this year, and I only need one ticket. I don't care if I stand up. And he says, again, I would like to help you, my son, but there's nothing I could do. I said, well, do you know when the guy in charge comes? Because maybe I could talk to him. And he says, well, I happen to be the rabbi in charge, and I'm also in charge of sweeping sometimes, and I'm here to tell you there are no tickets. He says, but tonight is the Sabbath, and we have services tonight. Maybe you should come and see if you like what we do. And I was like, okay. I just got schnunkered by this old man. I said, okay, I'll come tonight after services. And I told Barry Kemp that day, I think I'm going to be busy, Rosh Hashanah. I go to services that night. I walk in. There are about 20 people in this tiny little room. And I sat at the back because I felt so uncomfortable. And now the old man came out, and he was wearing his robes, and he looked just like a rabbi, like he stepped out of a production of Fiddler on the Roof. And he begins, he says, we'd like to sing the song, Hinei Matov, which I had no idea what it was. And I'm looking up in the book. I can't remember any Hebrew. I don't know what we're doing. He asks everybody to sing, and I'm sitting at the back silent. And while the 20 people sing, he stops and stop. And without looking at me, he says, you know, now is not the time to be looking at prayer books or to be, now's the time to sing. Just put your prayer books down and just sing along with everyone else. So we all began again and again. I didn't know what to do. So I sat at the back staring into space. And again, without looking at me, he stopped. Everyone stop. He says, you know, there are a lot of reasons why people come to a synagogue. for some of us, it may have been a long time since we've been here. Maybe we don't know our prayers. Maybe we've even forgotten our Hebrew. Well, guess what? I know Hebrew very well. I will do the Hebrew for you, and all you have to do is sing la-la-las and be happy. I went like, this guy is for me. And so I started coming to this synagogue for the next 10-some-odd years until our rabbi passed away. And by the time I finished, I was helping with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services. So then I became a regular visitor and a regular at the synagogue. I go to a different synagogue now, but that's another story. When my mother passed away, I ended up going in Judaism. You have to go twice a day to honor the death of a parent. So you go 7:30 in the morning, 7:30 at night. Because I am a character actor, I am often unemployed for huge periods of time. So I had the time to observe that obligation. And I went for 11 months, morning and night, and it made a huge difference in dealing with loss. It was an amazing thing. But, you know, there's a lot of amazing things from the past that we kind of discard, kind of toss away.
Man, you are so easy to listen to, and most people aren't.
Then you're in a terrible business.
Yeah. So what's a good Jewish boy like you doing in the Christian Mingle movie?
Let me tell you, that's a good question. Two things. First of all, my friend Corbin Burnson asked me, will you be in the Christian Mingle movie? I said, sure. And he gave me the script, and I read the script, and I went like, this is fine. This is so good. And I went like, who wrote this thing? And then I looked, and Corbin Burnson wrote it. And I called him up, and I was so excited. I said, Corbin, this is such a beautiful script. It's such a beautiful story. I have to tell you, it's like one of the best scripts I've read all year. And
so would you say it was as close to a Capra film as you've worked on?
That's the way I define it. It is as close to a Frank Capra film as anything I've worked on, because, you know, a lot of people think of Capra films as sentimental, but they're not really. Because in Capra films, there are real consequences, which give them depth. And in Christian Mingle, it is the story of this girl who's stuck in a position of trying to find purpose and love in her life. And she's at the verge of finding neither, which is a situation that a lot of people are in these days. And I felt like the script did not make any shortcuts and did not have any easy answers for her. And I found it enormously compelling. In terms of faith and religion and that kind of thing, I think it's a very personal quest people have. One thing my old rabbi said, who got me my ticket for the High Holy Day, is he said, you know, the mistake people make in their lives is there is physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual health. They're all important. If you let any one of those four things unattended, the entire body dies. And in different periods of history, we have different crises, and in the period of history we're in now, we don't tend to take the spiritual as seriously as we should.
Yeah.
And consequently, you see the body dying, not only of young people with no purpose, of nations not knowing which way they're going or what they're doing. It's amazing to watch what happens when you have no spiritual center. Not saying that everyone doesn't have a spirit. You know, I'm not overstating the case, but that's just the age we're living in now. So it was refreshing for me to look at Christian Mingle, which says, like, here's a girl who has intelligence, who has emotional acumen. Here is someone who is successful, but somehow she cannot find love, and somehow she cannot find purpose. What is she going to do? And in a very funny, very real way, she goes on a quest to find it. And I found it very compelling.
I did too. I have the spiritual gift of pessimism. And and when I watched, I heard Christian Mingle movie, Christian Mingle, they did a great job saturating the market. It's now a cultural phenomenon. The word is in our, sort of comedic vocabulary. Yeah. But I have such a respect for them as an organization, as actually a dating online. When online dating first started, I kind of made fun of it, like probably most did. But, boy, I've got a 22-year-old daughter, and I wish she kind of went that route instead of spending any time with D-bags one-on-one. I'd rather her sort everything out online first and then spend time with them. And the whole faith thing being a background, a common denominator. And then the movie, and I go, oh, gee, I hope it's not this. I hope it's not, I hope it's not starring Kirk Cameron, that kind of thing. And and then I watched it, and I went, okay, all right. And I should have figured that out with Corbin because, he's a pretty authentic guy. And anyway, I was pleasantly surprised at the end of it. It's a good little rom-com.
Yes. I'm very proud of Corbin and what he did. And, the amount of work he did to bring this idea and this story to life, it's so difficult to do what he did. And it's I was real happy to be a part of it, that's for sure.
Folks, just about time to say goodbye here to Stephen Tobolowsky from the south of Russia. I don't know why I keep saying that.
Can I tell you a quick story about that?
Is it going to be the story where the lady is helping you with your neck injury and she...
No.
Oh.
Not that one. It's about, the story about pronouncing my name?
With the Y instead of the I?
No.
Man.
About, I didn't know how to pronounce... I heard you guys arguing over how to pronounce my name at the beginning of the show. We had our first talk over.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to pronounce my name. This was just a few years ago because different people in our family pronounce the name differently. Some say Tobolowsky, some say Tobolowsky, some say Tobolowsky, Tobolowsky. So I went to our de facto historian, Uncle Nathan, and I said, Uncle Nathan, how do I pronounce my name? Now, I have to say, I'm 63. This was like 10 years ago. So I'm 53 years old.
Right.
And I'm saying, Uncle Nathan, how do I pronounce my name? And he says, well, you pronounce it any way you want because it's not really your name.
Wow.
I mean, what? And he says, when grandfather came to America, he came into not Ellis Island, but through Galveston, Texas. And the fellow there said, who are you? Grandfather, who didn't understand English, thought the who was wo in German, which is where. And thinking, he said, where are you from? And he was saying, I'm Abram from Tobolsk. In his Russian Jewish accent, I'm Abram from Tobolsk. And so the guy stamped the thing saying, you're Abram Tobolowsky. So that means I got my name the same way Don Corleone got his name in The Godfather.
Oh, he's here all week, folks. Wow. Well, man, I wish it wasn't a radio show. Actually, I wish we were at, not Art's Deli, but Jerry's. I like Jerry's better. Do you like Art's or Jerry's?
Well, I was a friend of Art, and I love both.
Okay. All right. I had breakfast with John Ratzenberger at Jerry's a number of years ago. He's an interesting guy. Have you ever met John?
I have met him, but not worked with him.
Right.
He seems like a really nice guy.
Yeah, he is a guy. We're talking about Cliff Clavin. Listen, we've run out of time, so I can't talk about Dangerous Animals Club, a fantastic book. I wish I could talk to you about the time you were held hostage at gunpoint in a grocery store. I'd love to hear the story about you being thrown from the horse in Iceland, breaking your neck, and almost dying. By the way, are there any Jews in the Cowboy Hall of Fame? I don't think so. I'd love to hear about my adventures with God. I'd actually like to read that. But I kind of need to end the interview with the way I started the interview. And it's another quote of yours. I went to your blog. I read the one about acting in belief. And, dude, this sentence, at my point in life, where I'm at spiritually and whatever else is going on in my head, my soul, here it is.
Yeah.
Perhaps real is not necessary to find true. If anything's going to make me start smoking up, it's going to be a line like that.
Stanislavski or St. Paul could have written that, right?
Yeah, that's you are a wordsmith, my friend. You really are.
Well, as soon as my adventures with God is now at Simon and Schuster, and the editor is reading it, and when he finishes it, I'll send you a copy.
Oh, that goes right to the top of the stack on the bedside table. What a pleasure to chat with you. I knew it would be great. You're a fantastic storyteller. The only other person I know that tells stories as good as you is Larry King. He just is just ridiculous with his stories. You know, he rear-ended JFK. That doesn't sound right. He smashed into him with his car when they were younger. Anyway, sir, I wish you the best. I really do. And I actually am going to creep on you on social network stuff. I'm going to just kind of keep my eyes on what you're doing, because you do bring the spice to whatever you do.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Drew. Thank you.
Great to chat with you, Stephen. Thank you.
Good talk with you, too. Adios.
Bye-bye. Stephen Tobolowsky, or any way you want to say it, on the Drew Marshall Show. Boy, we're totally running out of time here, but man, that was fun. I like that guy. Short break. Stay with us.
It's hard to find quality guest speakers these days. If they're interesting, they're usually expensive. And if they're cheap, they're usually boring. Well, here's someone who's both expensive and boring. Drew Marshall is a high school dropout who tried to become a pro football player but didn't make it. He then tried to become a firefighter and didn't make it. Now he's trying to become a stand-up comic. Good luck with that, Mr. Marshall. But if you're looking for someone who's unpredictable, incredibly honest, provocative, genuine, then we've got the right guy. Everyone seems to be an expert on something these days. Why not book someone who's an expert on nothing, except how to be brutally honest about yourself and your faith? To book Drew Marshall as your guest speaker, go to drewmarshall.ca.